Today I will first of all make up for some topic left out in the tutorial on Monday, which is the application of neural networks in the area of language modeling. This is the computation and use of prior probabilities built with, neural networks, prior probabilities for symbol sequences. This is usually, in this case, word sequences, but it could also be character sequences, as you will see. So let's start with a short history of neural networks in language modeling. The first approaches came around end of the 80s in Japan, for, in this case, neural networks for English word category prediction by Nakamura and Shikano in 1989. Then in 1993, some simple form of recurrent network was used for inference of stochastic regular languages. Then in 2000, the first neural probabilistic language model was introduced, and the area really got momentum when Holger Schwenk at LIMSI in Paris introduced continuous space language models, and I will also say more about this specific part of neural network language modeling, which is related to the problem that you have to build context-dependent models for quite a large number of symbols, in this case words. So you have like vocabularies on the order of 100,000s, and that's not a trivial task if you are thinking about getting the probability for all the words of the vocabulary in the context of a number of predecessor words. So that's a considerable combinatorial problem, and in the end, the neural network language models really are really a nice tool here. Then, in so what was done until then were feed-forward neural networks. Then, in 2010, Mikolov and co-workers introduced the first recurrent approaches to language modeling. The interesting point is, once you have a recurrent neural network, you can actually model unlimited context dependency, at least implicitly. What you will get effectively as context dependency then is more or less directed by your training data and the amount of training data, and by how much you can get out of this training data. Then 2 years later, we introduced the specific LSTM, long short-term memory recurrent neural network, to language modeling, which gives considerable additional improvements over the standard recurrent neural network. And then again 2 years later, we also showed that even with feed-forward neural networks, you can get similar results if you allow for very long range dependencies, and I will also talk about that here. So today, neural network based language models show competitive results and give really nice improvements on top of the count based models as I introduced them on Monday. And although the improvements, the relative improvements, are not that large as they are for acoustic modeling. So again, one word on perplexity, the standard quality measure for language models. So as a reminder, perplexity is the inverse geometric average of the sequence probability, and the interpretation here is that you have an average effective vocabulary size given by the number the perplexity gives you. So usual perplexities for large vocabulary tasks are on the order of 100. So here you see like perplexities between 90 and 130, depending on what trained model you use. And the first question certainly is, this is a statistical measure, and the question is, how is it connected to word error rate? And the idea here is, you have a given acoustic model, which certainly also has an influence on the overall error rate. But then if you keep that acoustic model constant and you just vary the language model, the prior probability for the symbol sequence, what is the effect, or what is the relation between perplexity and word error rate? And Clarko and Peters in 2002 already proposed that there should be a power law dependency based on their empirical evidence. And we actually redid these experiments. At the time when this was proposed, there were only the count-based language models, and we actually wanted to check if this approximative relation still is the case for other forms of neural networks. And this actually is the case. So here we have a log-log plot of perplexity against word error rate. And you can see there is like a count-based language model, which here has the highest perplexity. Then you have some feed-forward language models in green, some recurrent ones in blue, and long short-term memory recurrent ones in pink here. And you can see these all lie more or less nicely on a straight line, which means, as it's a log-log plot, that we have approximate power law here.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. You say it's a log-log plot, both axes look linear to me.
Well, it's because if you look at the range, you cannot really see that it's log-log.
Okay.
So if you have just the range between 90 and 130, you do not readily see that this is plotted in the log on the log range.
You know, I was
and similar for here.
I was wondering exactly the same thing, but now I realize if I squint, between 120 and 130 is shorter than between 90 and 100.
Yeah. Oh, tiny bit, you're right.
But you really, I mean, it's just the range. I mean, it's not like it's not like you don't see several orders of magnitude here. It's just around like a single. It's not even covering a single order of magnitude here. Okay, so and this is still a limited range. We wanted also to make sure that this even generalizes to even other ranges of perplexity. So now here we have the range from 100 up to 2000. So what we did was we took the K count-based models and we deliberately made them worse by taking less data, for example. We can do that easily. And still, I mean, what we saw before is happening down here. So between 90 and 130. Now we go up to 2000. I think now you can also see that it's really a log-log plot. And still, we here lie more or less on a straight line. As I said, this was originally proposed by Clarko and Peters in 2002. We also started to, we tried to also get some analytical dependence here. So we wanted to prove this dependency. We already found an upper bound between error rate and perplexity, although this is far away from this power law, and this is still ongoing work. More or less, I mean, more theoretical work, but we try to also get this dependency here put in an analytical way and get it proven. And then you could also look more detailed. So you could say, well, I don't look like on a complete corpus and measure the error rate globally, but I could also look into just a window of a few words, in this case, three words. So word position plus minus one word. We can measure the perplexity locally, and we can also measure the word error rate locally, and then average. So we do histograms. So how, what average word error rate we get for perplexities in specific bins, and still we get this nice power law behavior. So this seems to be a quite a general rule. What is not known is, I mean, there should be some dependency of the acoustic model here. As I said, it's always kept constant for these experiments, but it will possibly, it certainly has an effect on the absolute level of word error rate, but what we don't know is if it also has an effect on the gradient or on the power of this power law. Okay, so this is just to show that perplexity really is a meaningful measure for language modeling and is directly connected to word error rate, which is our ideal goal or ideal objective.
Excuse me.
Yes.
This is probably because I missed the last few days. Could you redefine perplexity for?
It was here on the first slide.
Yeah.
So it's the inverse geometric average. So the probability for a word sequence W1 up to N, which is usually decomposed. So what you don't model this directly. You model probabilities of words in the context of predecessor words. Usually for count-based models or for feed-forward models, you make a Markov assumption here. So you limit the dependency to a local number of words, like three or four predecessor words. But with recurrent neural networks, implicitly, you actually keep the complete context. But you have the product over all word positions here. And then you take the nth root and you invert it, and then the probability becomes effectively a frequency. So the interpretation is, even if you have a vocabulary of 100,000 words, and in each position you have to decide between all these 100,000 words, this number would give you the statistically based effective number of words which are meaningful with respect to their probability. And this is, as I said, directly connected to word error rate.
So this is for like different languages or different?
No, this is, so you have to keep, as I said, you have to keep the acoustic model fixed. Uh-huh. This is one of the problems. So when we did this proof here, we did not do any assumptions. So that's why this proof, although it's a tight bound, it's not even near to what we see here, because we did not do any assumptions, for example, to the acoustic model. So we even averaged over all possible acoustic models, and that's possibly the problem. So, and we're investigating this currently also. So the hypothesis is you have a given acoustic model and you only vary the language model. So you only vary the perplexity of your language model, and then the hypothesis is that you have an approximate power law.
What would be an example of hyperplexity versus low hyperplexity?
Sorry?
What's an example of hyperplexity versus low perplexity?
Well, a very, very simple example would be if you contrast a zero-gram language model against a unigram language model. What does that mean? A zero-gram language model is if you have no information and you can only assume a uniform distribution. So each word would be, would have the same probability. That's the simplest case for perplexity calculation. It can even be calculated without a corpus because there's no constraint. So the perplexity can only be the size of the vocabulary.
So that's high or low?
It's high, it's very high. So bad perplexity means high perplexity means no constraint on the number of words, or not much constraints on the number of words. So if you have no information, you still have the complete vocabulary. So if you have 100,000 words, then the perplexity would be 100,000. If you then even apply a unigram, so you count how often each word appears, even independent of the surrounding words, then I mean, it depends on the task, on the corpus, what number you will get. But like a simple task with a 5,000 word vocabulary, 0 gram, 5,000 unigram, 700 maybe.
I see. So it drops off.
Yes, yes, and quite fast. So
the relative word position.
Yeah. So maybe I can let me dig out. I just have to. Just a moment. No, this is my introduction. So I have some.
This is where the short-term memory model makes such a difference.
Yeah.
Now it's just a moment.
Large. Yeah. On your smartphone, if you have a text auto suggest, you
have
can see
one.
What your smartphone things for text language model.
Oh, you can't find it currently. So I just have to cite out of. I just have to cite out of my memory now. So if you have a simple task like 5,000 words, I can't find it currently. So 0 gram vocabulary size, 5,000, unigram, 700, bigram, slightly less than 200, trigram, 130, for example. So it really, for each word, additional word in the context you introduce, you get considerable drops. You might have tasks like especially spontaneous speech. There, the problem is you don't get text data because, I mean, you need to transcribe spontaneous dialogues, which is usually not done so much. So you don't have the text data. You don't, therefore, the text data usually is syntactically much more correct. So you don't have things like hesitations, like false starts, like broken words. And all this you can only have if you actually have transcriptions of spontaneous data. And then the perplexity can be much higher. Or if you have mismatch conditions, you trained on the wrong, say, topic, for example, you also get higher values. So you could also have tasks where you have like 500 or 400. Okay. So I think I would leave it at that. So what you should bear in mind is perplexity is a good measure, and it's directly related to error rate. So neural network-based language modeling. So what we have to distinguish in general is subsymbolic and symbolic processing. Subsymbolic is like the speech audio, text images, image and video data in computer vision, for example. And symbolic processing here would mean language modeling, and also symbolic processing you would have for the class conditional model for machine translation, because you translate from a symbolic level into a symbolic level, from source to target language in that case. But here we only want to consider building a class, a symbol sequence prior probability. So what you can always do is, if you have a probability for a sequence, you can use the chain rule and decompose it into a product of probabilities for individual words when keeping the complete context. This is mathematically exact. Now, how can we model these probabilities? With count models, you have a model-free approach. And if you optimize that with, a model-free apart from the assumption that you have a Markov assumption, that you have a limited local context. And if you have done that, then effectively, if you train with perplexity, which is the same as maximum likelihood for this case, you get relative frequencies, which you have to smooth, because lots of these relative frequencies are zero, as I pointed out on Monday. You can also build these language models with multi-layer perceptrons. In that case, you also limit the history, and you use the predecessor words actually as the input to your neural network to hypothesize the probability of all words of the vocabulary in the next word position. And then you can even take recurrent neural networks, and I will also go into the details here. So first of all, we have to care of how to present our evidence on the input side to the neural network. And this already is a problem, because we have symbolic representations, but the neural network actually works in this continuous space. So what is done is that you represent the words of your vocabulary with a vocabulary dimensional vector, where you have a one in the position which is related to the, say, the count or the number of that word in your vocabulary, and zeros otherwise. So that's the kind you represent, but this is a very high dimensional input. If you have 100,000 words, you have 100,000 dimensional vector. So the idea, first of all, is to do a dimension reduction, or a projection layer, we call that. This is a linear operation, so you do not have an activation function in that case. So what you want to have is like a sparse representation of these words, and also to learn this sparse representation, to also learn, say, relations between words, which are, for example, occurring in similar contexts, for example. And these should possibly get similar representations. We also call these representations word embeddings. And that's something you usually share upon all the words in the context. So if you have more than one word in the context for a feed-forward neural network, then you use the same embedding for each word in the context. Then the output layer would be the conditional probability of a word given a history. So H here usually represents a not yet defined number of predecessor words. Could be no word, could be one or two, or it could even be the complete sequence from the start of your sentence. And you do a softmax operation for normalization, so you need a normalized probability here.
How does the history get in? if it's a feed-forward network.
So the structure looks like that. So for each word in the context, so for example, if you have a trigram language model, you have the probability of a word in the context of the direct two predecessor words. So for each of the two predecessor words, you have your input vector, your one of V encoding, which then is reduced to the embedding vector, which has a much lower dimensionality. Yeah. And these are fully connected to the hidden layer.
So your input layer is the number of words of context times the vocabulary size.
Yes.
So that's
yes.
The enormous.
Yes. Okay. Well, on this level, yes. But yeah. I mean, the embedding is something you can pre-compute. So once you have trained your neural network language model, you can compute the embedding for each word of the vocabulary, so you don't have to compute this projection each time you use it. So you compute it beforehand for each word of the vocabulary, and then you just use a lookup table.
Is word-to-vec one of the embeddings that's used here, or is that something entirely?
Sorry?
Word-to-vec, the embeddings that like the Google team, I think, uses?
Yes, that's exactly what we were talking about.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, it might differ slightly in the way it was trained or it was where how the parameters were shared and so forth. The problem is with the softmax, so first the training is done with perplexity as introduced, which is equivalent to cross entropy as we use it for frame-wise training in the acoustic modeling part, and we actually also use early stopping here by cross-validation on a development corpus. One of the problems we have here, again, not only on the input side, where we solve the high dimensionality of the input vectors by the word embeddings, we also have the problem with the output side. So you need a probability for each word of the vocabulary, so you have to compute softmax over an order of 100,000 words, which is also a complexity problem. And I will also say something about that. One of the possible remedies would be to use word classes, which are automatically trained, the normalized outputs of the softmax then actually fit nicely into the perplexity criterion. So I already mentioned, so this would be, say, a standard feed-forward structure for a multi-layer perception-based neural network language model. You have your one of V encodings for a trigram in this case. Here you have the embeddings, and then you have your hidden layer, and you have your output layer. Now, if you could also factorize your language model probability, so the probability for a word in the context of some predecessor words into the product of the probability of a word class given that context, and a probability of the word given the context and the word class, where you use unique word classes for each word. Okay, and therefore, if you hypothesize a specific word class, you only have to consider those words which lie within that word class, and this simplifies reduces the complexity of the approach. Now, you can also apply a language model with recurrent structures, which would enable you to discard the Markov assumption. So you do not have to assume a limited context in that case. So what you do is you have a hidden layer with recurrency, and therefore you only need a single input now, the current predecessor word, or the previous word you have had in your sequence. And the dependence on earlier words comes then implicitly through the recurrency here. And you can also do that with word classes in the same way as you do it for the feed-forward networks. And then you could also use the LSTM structure, although this would not change the overall approach. You just replace, say, the previous standard recurrent nodes with LSTM nodes in this case. And now I will give you some numbers. So we have here a task, an English task, which is so from the Quero project. This was parliamentary discussions. It was podcasts and broadcast news. The vocabulary size is 150,000, which is quite large for English. The training text in this case was limited to 50 million words, which is related to the fact that the training of these neural networks takes a much, much higher complexity than training the count-based models, where the count-based models could even be trained on 3 billion running words. So that's orders of magnitude more. And but here, for the results you see here, all of the models are trained on only 50 million words to have a direct comparison. So the count model gives us here a perplexity of more than 160. By using a multi-layer perceptron and modeling a 10 gram, so having a probability of a word in the context of 9 predecessor words, we get a considerable reduction in perplexity. Even with just a single hidden layer, adding a second hidden layer, we get some further improvement, although it's much less than by just introducing the MLPs in contrast to the count model. Then, using a recurrent network, we can have a further reduction. But what really gives us a huge further improvement is using the LSTM structure. And this reduces the perplexity to 108, and if we have a second layer, even down to nearly 100.
Yes? Sorry, I think I'm still a little confused by the perplexity measure, because I can think of ways to take a model and reduce the perplexity by reducing the probability and the output words down trivially. Just pick the same, with probability one, pick the same, regardless of the context, pick the same word with probability one as would, my model. It would be a terrible
model. It would work maybe on a single sentence, but it would not work on a whole corpus.
But that's what I'm missing, is I don't understand how the perplexity measure actually captures the accuracy of what the model is able to do. It's capturing the...
So the central question is, what is W1 up to N? It's a whole corpus.
Right.
So you have a trained model,
yeah,
which was trained on different data. So not on the word sequence you use to evaluate it. So here you use a whole corpus. It will also be a very large amount of data, tenth of thousands of running words. So if you say, well, I want to give a probability of one to this word in that context, it means that all the other words in that context will get probability zero.
Right.
And you just need a single zero to get infinite perplexity.
The
best connection you can produce is to add error rate. So perplexity certainly is a more abstract statistical measure, whereas word error rate is very easy to define and also intuitive measure. So I didn't possibly define it properly on Monday. So word error rate is the minimum number of edit operations you need to do to transform one sequence into another sequence. And the edit operations are just deletions, insertions, and substitutions. And perplexity, at least empirically, is directly related to word error rate. I will also give word error rate results. I will not reduce this discussion to perplexities. But
do I understand right? The perplexity is basically the conditional entropy of the output given the context. So, I mean, you could reduce the entropy
of the output. It's the inverse geometric average over probability of words in some position.
Right, but there's no notion in it of which word is the, you know, is it among the reduction in the support set that the significant probability is over. There's no notion of whether the correct word in a given instance.
So statistically speaking, it's a Kullback-Leibler distance. So you can define perplexity. Where's my?
Sorry, I think what we are looking for is basically you assume that now the distribution of sequences in your training data, like that matches with your actual.
That's what I wanted to say. So effectively, if you can have the true probability of a word sequence. So this is what your training data or infinite of training amount of training data would give you. Mm-hmm. And we know to get optimal results, we need to use this true prior in addition to the true acoustic model to get optimal word error rate on a speech recognition task. What you actually do is, if you would have an infinite amount of data, the complexity would translate into a Kullback-Leibler distance. So you would have the so the log perplexity would be would look like that, where on the left you have the true probability, and this is your model. And the best value you can get is if the model is the same as the true probability. So there's you can easily show that this is a bounding property, and so in the best case you take the true probability, and the perplexity actually increases the farther away you get from the true probability. Okay? So meddling around with single sequences doesn't make sense, because it would always have an effect on the complete measure. So if you say here I want to have a probability of one, it because of the normalization, it has an effect on all the other words, and it will show up. So there's no way in improving, for example, the best perplexity you can get if you would have the true probability distribution.
If there is training test mismatch, then you would use some.
But you would also see that, so because then you have trained this model on other data, even if in that case you would have an infinite amount of other data, it would represent other properties and it would not be the same as the true probability of your test data. And therefore you would still have a mismatch and you would still be off the optimal perplexity for the task which is represented by this true probability distribution. Okay, so maybe one additional point for the intuition. Certainly, this assumes that there is some stationarity involved. But certainly, you could think about ways to adapt. So for example, if you have a conversation and then the conversation changes to another topic, then certainly you could think about changing also the probability distribution underlying this, and certainly this would improve your results. So in a way, your comment is also has some true core, because if you could try to really adapt to the state, for example, a dialogue state or something like that. Although technically this has not been very successful. So to some extent you can get improvements, but they're still somewhat limited. Okay, so back to the results. So this was just using a limited set of 50 million running words for training, and this will always be the case for the neural network language models. We do not take more data than that. Just a word on the training times. It took half an hour to train the count model. It took 1 week to train the MLP. It took 3 weeks to train the LSTM recurrent neural network, just to give you an idea of the increase in complexity, in this case for training. However, the count model can even be trained on 3.1 billion words, which does not take much more time. And if I train on 3 billion words, the count model gives a much better perplexity, 130, but it's still off the best results we get even by just training on 50 million words for the corresponding neural network language models. In addition, we can combine the count model with the neural network model and get additional gains. So what we see here is 130 for the count model, 112 using the 10-gram multilayer perceptron with the count model, and we get a nice improvement in perplexity and also a nice improvement in word error rate from 12.4 to 11.5. Then with the recurrent network, we reduce slightly to 108 and also slightly to word error rate 11.1. With the LSTMs, we get a further considerable drop in perplexity to 10 and also to word error rate 10.8. If we use two layers for the feed-forward structure, we get 11.3 as opposed to 11.5. If we use two hidden layers for the LSTM structure, we drop from 10.8 to 10.4%, and finally to a perplexity of 92, which is considerably lower than the original perplexity of 130 for the count model. Yes?
What was the context length for the count model? Somehow I missed
it. It's a 10-gram. It's a 10-gram.
It's a 10-gram count model. Yeah.
So we get significant improvements by applying neural network language models. So best improvement in perplexity, 30% relative. Best improvement in word error rate, 16% relative. And as mentioned earlier, we see empirically, we see approximately a power law between word error rate and perplexity. Okay, so this was missing from Monday. And actually, this is quite good because the first topic I want to discuss now. So now I will present more recent and more specific research on applying neural network neural networks in speech recognition. And the first topic, so again, this is based on a work by quite a number of PhD students here, and all of what you see you can even do for yourself because all the tools are available on our website. So you can download our recognition system, RAZR we call it, or RWTH ASR. Also the LSTM based language modeling is published, and also recently we have a new interface between generic neural network training and modeling software and our recognition system. All of this is available under this URL. And just to give you an outline, so I will start today with some specific approaches to neural network language modeling, especially under the question of how can I improve genericity of the modeling and also of the training. For example, if I consider different languages on new tasks I have not seen before. Also, I will shortly discuss the problem of doing search with unlimited context language models or very long context language models. This is not directly related to neural networks, but it's a problem which is, say, a consequence of applying neural networks in language modeling. Then I will shortly discuss the relation between the hybrid and the tandem approach to acoustic modeling, and also a possibility to combine both or interpret tandem as a hybrid also. Then I will discuss what is maybe of the largest interest here, the problem of training the signal preprocessing directly as part of the acoustic model. Then I will discuss how we can improve recognition for a specific language by even taking evidence of completely different languages. And this is especially helpful when you have only a very low amount of data for your target language. And finally, I will discuss some very recent results, or very recent research on so-called end-to-end modeling, and also on questioning the hidden Markov model or trying to improve on the segmentation problem. Okay, so generic neural network language modeling. First point is word embedding on byte level does not really sound like being strongly related to hearing, but nevertheless, we just discussed neural network language modeling. One of the problems of the approach is that once you define your word embedding, you're limited to a fixed vocabulary. So you cannot just add one dimension and get an embedding for that. So the question is, how can we ease the generation of such language models, especially for new tasks and for also the case of extending your vocabulary? And there already have been works where this was done on character level, because where you have 100,000 words, often you just have a very low amount of characters. This certainly excludes languages like Chinese, so logographic languages, but this we do not discuss here. So another problem is if you handle, say, new or even exotic languages, is that you have to handle the international character encodings. And that led us to the approach that instead of even handling characters, to handle bytes. So depending on the language, a character might be encoded with 1, 2, or 3 bytes. And we don't care. We just say, OK, we just take the byte sequence. So for example, here you have a word of the Amharic language, which is an Ethiopian language. And you see 2 characters here, and each of the 2 characters here is modeled by 3 bytes. And this we take as input. So instead of originally directly generating word embeddings, we first of all generate byte embeddings. And then these byte embeddings are finally, you apply a convolution filter to this, which is trained. And you do some max pooling to, in the end, still get word embeddings. So we generate word embeddings via byte embeddings. So this gives us a much higher genericity and also eases training of, say, language of languages we have not seen before, and we want to be able to generate a language model in a short period of time. This approach actually we then embedded into our LSTM language modeling approach. So here you have your byte embeddings, you do a convolution, a pooling to get a word embedding, and from that on everything is more or less the same. What we also looked into is highway connections, where you actually skip a layer and you just give through the input to the next layer. And here are the corresponding experimental results. So our baseline LSTM language model here for the languages Igbo and Doluo, you get perplexities of around 104 and 145 by introducing the convolutional neural network based byte embedding. You get a considerable reduction in perplexity, and by introducing highway connections in one case, we got a very slight further improvement. In the other case, we got a slight degradation in perplexity. And this also translates into error rates. So don't wonder, these are very high error rates, but these also were very special tasks. So this was a very special project where the task was to train a system for a language you have never seen before, in a very short amount of time. In the end, we had 1 week for training the whole system. So, and the amount of data also was very limited. In the third year of the project, we had only 3 hours to train our system on. And even the language modeling part was limited to the transcriptions of these 3 hours, plus some web data for which you also had only a very limited amount of time, a fixed amount of time to generate that data or to get that data from the web. So the error rates are fairly high, so beyond 50% for Igbo in this case. But we see improvements from going from a 2-gram language model to an LSTM-based language model to a convolutional byte-level-based language model. And same for Doluo. Lower error rates, but you get improvements. What is very interesting is this task, or this project I was talking about, is not about mainly about word error rate improvement, but about keyword search performance. I will not go into detail about the measure here. You should know that bigger is better in this case. So it's a measure which gives you numbers up to 1, and which could also be negative if you have very bad results. This measure also takes into account that if you're missing a very infrequent keyword, you get a much worse contribution than if you get 1 of 1,000 occurrences of the same keyword wrong.
What would have been statistically significant in terms of differences on the keyword?
I can't tell you currently. Mm-hmm. So with the 2-gram language model, we get like here for Igbo a value of 0.38. 0.3759. With the LSTM, we even have a slight degradation, But with the byte level embedding, we get a nice improvement. And similar for Doluo, the LSTM does not even seem to make a difference. This is also related to the fact that the amount of data is very limited. So there's no use of unlimited context dependency if you can't if you don't have enough data to actually see that. But as you can see, it's also related to the embedding. So if you have a more generic embedding, you also get slight improvements. Then another interesting question to us was, is it really necessary to have recurrent neural networks, or can we also go with feedforward networks? And the question is, how large does the context need to be, and can we take better advantage of the amount of data? So you have seen the training times for 50 million running words. You need like half an hour for a count model and like 1 or 3 weeks for a feedforward or recurrent neural network. What you can do nevertheless, if you have enough machines, you can like divide your data into 50 million running words each and train language models in parallel and then combine them. But the question is, how can we combine neural network language models? So the usual approach for language model combination would be linear interpolation of count-based language models, where the interpolation weights are optimized on some target domain validation set, and this optimization is done using the expectation maximization algorithm. Count models are suited to be linear combined into one single model with the union of n-grams and recomputing the backup weights. The goal is to also do combination for neural network language models, aiming at a single model after interpolation of neural network language models. Linear interpolation is not straightforward for neural network language models, and log linear combination in this case fits better. And the initial investigation here was done for feedforward neural networks. And the idea is the following. You have a joint model where you have some shared hidden layers and input layer, but you have separate output layers. The advantage is that if you just look at the output layer, it's a log linear operation with a softmax. So therefore, you have some efficiency involved here. So we have multiple posterior estimates, and the active output is selected by the domain of the input vector, and the hidden layers are shared between the domains. And we therefore have a shared vocabulary and a common softmax. And the linear combination to obtain single overall neural network language models would lead to a weighted sum of domain-specific output layers, and the weighted sum of the softmax outputs can be rewritten as a single softmax output layer, which is an advantage. And to show you the results, so the training corpus now is the full training corpus for the Quero task, 3 billion running words from 11 domains, the GigaWord corpus, broadcast news, broadcast conversations, TED Talks, IWSLT is a conference in our area where also evaluation tasks are given out and corresponding data. And we use subsets of 50 million and 2 million running words of this data for selecting the best matching subset for fine-tuning. The count-based language model is Knezanai 4-gram with 130 perplexity, and the LSTM language model using the 50 million running words gives us a perplexity of 100.5. Retraining is only done on the multi-domain output, which is log linear and therefore also efficient, and which is done on the best bottleneck, and the interpolation here gives us a perplexity of 92. And now you can see, so here we have the perplexities for the fine-tuned case using 50 million running words. So by fine-tuning on 2 million running words, we get some slight improvement here. Working with the full set of 3 billion running words, by doing fine-tuning, we get a considerable improvement here by combination. Just fine-tuning, and by combination, we get further improvements. So, That was the wrong key. So in the end, we get a perplexity of 94.3. If we now compare on the level of word error rates, so having the count-based model, adding the feed-forward model trained on 50 million words, the same on 3 billion running words with fine-tuning, and then multi-domain, and comparing this to the recurrent LSTM model based trained on 50 million words, we see that in the end we can get similar error rates. Okay. So therefore this shows that we can also get the same error rate than an LSTM based model, which is nevertheless a feed forward model. And now and this was actually using a context of 20 words. I think I forgot to mention this. And the question, I mean, the problem certainly is the complexity for each additional word in your context, the theoretical or the naive complexity of already doing dynamic programming still increases by a factor of your vocabulary for each additional word in the context, and certainly you cannot do that. So the next question is, how can we use these language models efficiently? Either a recurrent network, a neural network-based language model, and one with a long but limited context. And the idea is to use some more simple model, account-based model with a shorter context, do a one-pass search. And instead of just generating the best recognized word sequence, you generate a representation of your search space, which we call word graph. And then you constrain the search using the larger neural network-based models on that word graph. And the problem is, if you look at that word graph, so this would be an example of such a word graph, applying a recurrent neural network means that you have to generate the full exponentially sized prefix tree of all possible hypotheses you can generate. So just working on the word graph is not sufficient, but you have to introduce approximations. And what we do is, even locally, we approximate by deciding which is the recurrent state to consider further, because the recurrent state implicitly encodes the context dependency, and therefore, like here, we have three different contexts and we compare them, and we only follow that one which gives us locally the best result. But on the other hand, also keeping diversity by keeping also other hypotheses we have seen in our word graph. And using that approach, we see some further improvement. The alternative would be a very simple approach using n best lists. So during the initial search, in that case, you just generate the 100 or 1,000 best word sequences, which your simple language model provides, and then you just apply your long context model for each of the sequences, which is much simpler. But you can see by doing word graph rescoring and adapting your search parameters to that case, you can get improvements. Slight improvements, but nevertheless, it's also much more efficient, because 1,000 best list does not really give you much variation, especially if you have long sequences. Okay, so and therefore, word graphs here are the approach of choice. Okay, so this concludes the topic of language modeling, and the next topic would be how we actually introduce neural networks into the acoustic modeling part. And on Monday I presented two major approaches, the tandem approach and the hybrid approach, the tandem being suggested later than the hybrid, but earlier giving nice improvements than the hybrid approach. We started about 10 years ago applying the tandem approach and really got nice results. And nowadays, most of the groups are using the hybrid approach. And what we wanted to do here is to compare these two. There already were some researchers suggesting joint training of, in the tandem approach, of the neural network and the Gaussian mixture model on top of that. And what we will give here is an interpretation which shows that the combined tandem and Gaussian mixture model actually could also be viewed as a specific form of neural network and certainly then also trained jointly. And the idea for this approach is the equivalence between Gaussian mixtures and corresponding log linear models with hidden parameters. So joint, bottleneck, and tandem. So this would be the structure if you apply, if you insert tandem into your usual Gaussian mixture approach. And if you reinterpret the Gaussian mixtures as log linear models, there have been some works, especially by one of our PhD students, Georg Heigold, who actually showed for a number of cases that we have this equivalence. And then you can actually interpret the output of your Gaussian mixture as a softmax and max pooling layer, where the softmax actually is a very, very large layer, because usually the number of Gaussian distributions we consider is on the order of a million. So nevertheless, the advantage is we do not need special elements. So so sum and max pooling is available, softmax certainly. We then have a common structure which we can train jointly, even within the same software. And what we have to do is, this is on the next page. Where was it? So what you have to care about is that you need to care about complexity here because of this very large hidden layer. So what you do is you do a low rank factorization. So you one of the hidden layers, so the hidden layer directly before the softmax can be done as a bottleneck and therefore reduces the computation considerably. To give you some results, so if we have a hybrid approach, again on the Quero English task I have shown before, we have here error rates of 13.3 and 18.1 on development and evaluation part of the test data. If we do a low rank factorization also for the hybrid case, we get a slightly worse error rate here. But if we increase the number of outputs, so the outputs are clustered triphones, and then we can even get a further improvement by that. And if we compare to a bottleneck tandem approach, in that case we have a much higher number of parameters if we don't have the corresponding bottleneck structure. If we have a large number of splits, the bottleneck we have anyway, then we get a slightly suboptimal result. But if we reduce the number of splits and do joint training, then we get almost the same results as with the hybrid approach. And that's our current, that was a paper from 2015. Recently, we will present on a conference in September much newer results where we again can show that the hybrid approach and the tandem approach can be done in a way that they perform similar.
Is this then with sum pooling or with max pooling? It doesn't make a difference for the results if you add or if you just take
This is done with max pooling, actually.
And did you look at the difference? I would be curious to see.
I don't have the numbers here, so I would have to look that up. I can't tell you by heart, currently. But I don't think that this makes a difference. We are talking about the output from the Gaussian mixtures, and the output of the Gaussian mixtures usually is very pronounced for a specific quantity.
But if there's confusion, it's...
Yes, but yeah. On the other hand, when you do the training, each splitting step gives you a better separation. Mm-hmm. So the variance, if you compute a global a variance, you will see that, and it even is independent of the assumption, but systematically the variance will decrease for each splitting step. And therefore, if you do a sufficient number of splits, you can safely assume that the maximum and the sum are similar. Okay, and with that, we come to one of the more interesting topics here. So how can we directly work with our original signal in the time domain? So how can we do acoustic modeling of the raw time signal? There has been some previous work on that. So generally, there has been a large effort invested into feature engineering for neural network-based acoustic modeling. Previous work showed that a simple, fully connected 12 hidden layer deep neural network performs well even without any feature extraction. So to take the results first, so if we take MFCCs, we got 22.1%. And by not even changing the whole structure, by just taking the raw time signal instead of the MFCCs, we got an increase of only about 15% relative. In that case, the first layer, we actually analyzed the first layer and found that it actually shows impulse responses which are similar to bandpass filters. And the learned filter bank roughly resembles manually defined filter banks, so you also see, say, the increase in bandwidth for higher frequencies, for example. The next step then was, or a natural step then was to actually apply convolutional structures for these early layers in the network. And the research question here was, how much do convolutional structures reduce the performance gap to the handcrafted features, and how can we interpret the learned weights? So convolutional networks have been introduced already some 25 years or more ago, especially for handwriting. They were quite successful. Lacan and co-workers did that at that time. And they are currently state-of-the-art for computer vision. They can also be applied to speech recognition tasks where the two-dimensional filters would act on spectrograms, so would do a convolution on spectrograms. And if you do that, if you do convolution on the raw time signal, certainly, first of all, you have only a one-dimensional convolution. And but nevertheless, on the output of that, you can also define two-dimensional convolution. And what you also can do is temporal subsampling. This is also more or less a necessity because of complexity. So you can't do that. Or, I mean, you can define it for each sample, but at that point, we really reduced the complexity. So convolution and time would look like that. So you have a number of filters, I here numbering the different filters. And each filter would act on, on a moving window in your original time signal. Now you can certainly then also do two-dimensional convolution on the next level. So if your input would be a spectrogram, you would do, would define a local window within your spectrogram, and then you would do also a number of filters extracting features from that level. However, if you train all levels at the same time, you do not yet have this interpretation because you don't know what will be the filters on the in the first layer, so you cannot interpret like frequency on the next level unless you have trained your model and analyze it. And that's what we did. And interestingly, if we train these first two convolutional layers as part of the whole network, the first layer, so here you see the corresponding impulse responses as they come out, so they're completely unordered. But now if we look at the corresponding transfer functions and order them by their center frequency, then what you see is something very similar to critical bands.
What paper is this from?
Sorry?
Which paper is this from?
Should be given at some point. Well, did I omit that?
Anyway, this is from your group.
It's our group, yes, yes.
All right, I'll look it up. Sorry.
Should be. Oh, I have to put it into the slides. Oh, here it is. So it's this one.
It's the nonlinearity of this convolution.
It's, as far as I remember, it's a sigmoid. It's a sigmoid, yes.
If I recall right, Google in their system, they have some logarithm thing. Google has done something similar, right?
Yeah.
So, why would you have the logarithm there to mimic the amplitude compression?
Yeah.
You don't have a test.
No, as far as I remember, we only used the sigmoid up to now.
Okay. Is there some reason not to use compression or
sorry?
Is there some reason not to use logarithmic compression?
No. I mean, we're still investigating this. We're also trying to use LSTMs for these steps. Then you possibly more use rectified linear units in that case. So, yes, but I mean, certainly you have an activation function for each level. Okay, so that's the first layer. Now, using this ordering in the analysis, we can then also look at spectral temporal receptive fields. So,
the output of that first layer, that's downsample, so do you
yes, you don't have that for each sample, but we downsample that by 32 samples.
Is it max pooling?
It's max pooling, yes.
Are you worried at all about the sampling theorem?
Sorry?
Are you worried at all about the sampling theorem?
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Are you worried at all about the sampling theorem, about like getting aliasing or anything like that?
Well, I'm thinking about that, so I mean, it's also a complexity problem, but
yeah.
For example, when talking about high temporal resolution in something like face locking, for example, you could also only get if you have a much higher resolution at that point. So I'm wondering if maybe there is more to get. So having said this,
By what factor are you actually?
So you have some filters here which do not really fit into the picture, and I wonder if you do say less smearing out at that point, if you would also be able to take advantage of higher time resolution. But that's something we do not investigate yet.
I'm just more asking about the fact. So by what factor are you downsampling?
32.
32. So that's enormous, right?
On the sample level.
Yeah, I mean that's enormous. So you should get massive aliasing, right?
Sorry?
You should get massive aliasing in the output unless it's low pass filtered first, right?
Bandpass filters in every band, you have a lower effective bandwidth probability.
What do you mean by aliasing?
I mean, the sampling theorem, which states that like if this a signal that you are downsampling and it has content above the Nyquist limit, which is half the sampling rate.
Well, we do not downsample.
You'll get the high frequencies moving into the low frequencies.
Maybe this is a misunderstanding. So we do not downsample the signal, but we do not evaluate this by shifting the window by a single sample each time. So we shift the window 32 samples at a time. But the window itself is working on
the... Sorry? The
window is yes, certainly.
Yeah, I'll bug you about it later. I'll talk to you about it later.
Yeah, okay.
In the time window itself, the length you choose?
It should be given here at some point. That's something I wanted to write down. I think it was some 106. No, it was. It's similar to what we usually have when we do our short-term analysis, which is with 60 kilohertz. You have 25 milliseconds, so 400 samples in that case. But here it's 256. Yeah, right. 256 it was. Yes, right. You can see it implicitly here.
Yeah. Was the size of these 2D filters on the second layer?
You directly see that here. So you have 16. No, this is given as time. Well, I mean, we have a downsampling. So once you have the one-dimensional filter on the first level, you downsample by a factor of 32. So you only have 16 filters here, and then here you have 64 dimensions for so 64 filters for from the first level. So you have, so these are 64 filters, so 64 bands, more or less. And in the time dimension, you have 16.
So if you have the filter phase process?
Yes, on the second layer.
But then how can you do convolutional frequency if your filter length or then do you just zero that?
I mean,
is your number of frequency bands the same as your, the number of size of your filter?
Sorry?
The number of frequency bands is the same as the size of your filter. So how do you do the convolutional frequency?
I mean, the problem is you cannot assume locality because you do not know in the first hand where. So you don't have this frequency interpretation when you build up the model. So this is something you need the model to train from. So you don't have like convolution. So in that case, you take the complete input because the model needs to be able to see which is the important parts to get here.
So it's not convolutional frequency, it's only in time.
Yes.
So, okay.
Okay, so so this is the filters we get. So you have structures like that where you have, say, a strong time dependency. You have also structures like that where you see like slight changes in frequency. And this is only part of the filters we obtained. And with this approach, we actually got nice improvements. So if you take the MFCC features, you have 22.1%. If you use the raw time signal, but you do not change the neural network structure, you get 25.5%. But if we change the structure and the first layers to convolutional networks, we get 23.4%. And therefore, the gap between MFCC-based performance and raw-time signal performance drops from 15% relative difference to 6% relative difference. Having said this, you should bear in mind this is a task where the training amount of training data is 250 hours. Google also worked into that direction, even including multi-channel data, but they had much more data, and they were able to even get similar results to what you get with a specific manually defined pre-processing. So the end of the story here is, I mean, we do not use this approach yet for evaluation systems because we do not yet get really improvements from training the features. But academically, the interesting point is here, you are able to train features and they are even meaningful. So you get a frequency interpretation, you get even something near to critical bands, and also the spectral temporal representations you get, the receptive fields you get, are also meaningful with respect to what you would expect in a corresponding spectrogram.
What would really interest me, but maybe this is too academic a question, is what would happen if you were to give this network structure the features that are typically used with the MEL scale and with the convolution filters that we would expect signal theoretically, and then backprop and see if it gets better from there, looking for this global optimum, which maybe might even be, I mean, the optimum you would get would probably...
You mean that you initialize your process? That's what we did also.
Okay.
So,
okay.
I mean, certainly when you start this, it doesn't work,
yeah.
The first case.
Yeah, yeah.
So first point would be to really initialize your filters in a meaningful way, so in a way which is at least similar to what you have before.
And if you were to be able to initialize it in the very same way that signal theoretically would choose?
I mean you should get better results in that case. So. Mm-hmm. But it's also a question, not necessarily because you should get better on your training data, but the question is, does it generalize well? And that's say one of the problems. If we're talking about the original raw time signal, we are talking of much higher variability. And it's clear if you want to learn that, you also possibly need more data at some point or a better idea of how to constrain your modeling. So one step we have seen here, so constraining the modeling from fully connected DNNs to CNNs it already makes a large difference.
Yeah.
So, and there might be more to this. But then it's also kind of, in my view, it's also kind of reintroducing the knowledge about pre-processing in only one higher level of abstraction.
Yeah.
So instead of defining the pre-processing, you define the structures. But it's also interesting to understand, so what are the necessary structures for a network which is nevertheless trained?
Yeah.
Okay, so then just to mention this, so you could also talk about robustness problems. I think we already have seen something on this. So you could like define, say your acoustic model is a neural network, but you could also say, well, not only like feature extraction, but also enhancement could be done by a neural network. And if you train that in an isolated way, you could say, well, if I have stereo data, so if I have not only the noisy signal, but also the corresponding clean model, a clean audio, I could train a network to regenerate the clean signal given the input, the noisy signal. And you could, for example, use a squared error criterion to train such a network. And then you could even take such a network and train it jointly with the acoustic model. This was done by people from Georgia Tech and quite successfully. And then also, I already mentioned that you could do multi-channel processing. There are direct approaches which are quite successful, like the generalized eigenvalue beamformer introduced by people from Paderborn University in Germany. They got especially good results by defining signal masks for noise and speech based on recurrent neural networks. And this gave a really nice improvement. And recently, last year, we participated together with them and the fourth group in Greece in the CHIME evaluation. And in that evaluation, we made the second place with applying these methods. But the beamforming was actually not developed by us, but by the Paderborn people. We did the corresponding recognition systems. And as I mentioned, also multi-channel processing can be done on the raw waveform, and Google even claims that this is the best you can do, but then they also have the best amounts of data to do that. And in my view, still the question remains, if I have a limited amount of data, and you have cases where you get new tasks, you have only very limited amount of data, then either you wouldn't train the features, or you need much better knowledge on how to constrain your models. Okay, so then another interesting area we have been investigating for some years is the multilingual approach. The idea here is you have possibly only a limited amount of data for some target language, but you have large amounts of data for other languages. And the question is, can we learn properties of speech independent of the language and use it for arbitrary languages? And the question is actually yes. There are different approaches to do that. You could use not only the phone set of each language, but include the corresponding language ID and train them jointly. You could also try to define an international common phone set, but this also implies approximations which are possibly not optimal. And what actually works best from our experience is to define a neural network with a bottleneck, but then language-dependent output layers. So that's how such a structure would look like. This is already a more elaborate one. Maybe concentrate on half of this picture. So you have a neural network, you have a bottleneck, you have the last hidden layer, and then to the last hidden layer, you attach different languages. So when you do training, if you have a sentence from language one, you only do back propagation from this output layer. If you then have data from another language, language N, you do back propagation from that layer. And then in the end, you discard the output layer and the last hidden layer. You just take the network up to the bottleneck. And this will be a very high level feature which gives you a large improvement if then you train even on a completely new language you have not seen in training and with only having few data. Here we have a more specific structure which is also related to Hinek's work, where you have the MRASTA features. You take the fast modulations in the first network, and the output of the bottleneck is then taken together with the slow modulations into a second network. So it's a so-called hierarchical neural network, we call that. And this currently works very well for this multilingual cases. So we did experiments for well-resourced languages. So for example, here we our target task is French. If we train on the French data, for each task, we have limited the amount to 50 hours to have comparable amount of data. So we get 22.2%. And each language we add, we get improvements. So if we have multilingual approaches with several languages, each additional language, even though there might be languages like Polish, which are possibly not too much related to French, still they get improvement. In some cases here, by adding Polish to German and French, you only get a very slight improvement, which is certainly not significant. But in general, and we have done that for much larger amounts of languages, in the extreme case, we use 28 languages to train such models. And usually we see consistent improvements before adding new languages. And now you could also ask about the structures, so multi or unilingual bottleneck features. So having a baseline system only for the target language here, for each language, we have the corresponding error rates with some variation over the different languages. If we then, and this is just with MFCCs and Gaussian mixtures, if we then add our bottleneck features in a tandem fashion, we get nice improvements. But by adding the multilingual features, which were trained on all the four languages, for each of the languages, we get a further improvement. Some improvements being lesser for Polish, some improvements being larger as for German, English, and French. And now you could also do that on a much larger scale, especially using more languages. It's another point. So also the question is, how language dependent do we need to be at the output? So this was the alternative we were discussing up to now, but this gives you a very large weight matrix if you have a large hidden layer here in the at the last level before the output. But you could also say, well, I discard them anyway at some point. I could also make the last hidden layer language dependent. But as things are, the common hidden layer before the output layer works slightly better. So here you have the comparison for the four languages between using language-dependent hidden layers and language-independent hidden layers. And generally, the language-independent hidden layers work better, except for Polish. But there we also have like the best, the similar performance. Then. I will skip this one and move over to under-resourced languages. This is again the task I was talking about before. Yes?
So, I don't know, like many sensory systems,
yes,
they actually do lots of specific modulation already in the first stage of the processing. So,
yes.
Here you do it in the last stage. Then you try to move your language dependence also to the first initial state?
No. The idea was independent of the language, you always use the same vocal apparatus, certainly in different ways. But the idea is that, first of all, there's a lot of sharing. So you might have languages which do not, for example, distinguish between L and R, like in Asian language, some Asian languages. But then there's still a majority of phonemes which are shared or which are similar, and you want to take advantage of that similarity. By separating the layers at an early level, you go somehow much more back into the original picture where you have like different models for each of the languages. There have been groups which also investigated in training separate models for each of the languages and combining these, but the improvements were not as good as using this common shared network up to a high level.
But you could share the middle part of your network, basically, right?
Sure.
Adapt your language processing to the different languages.
I think this has not been done yet. I think, but I have to say I'm not too convinced of this approach. It will increase parameters and will deprive you of some of the advantage of taking advantage of redundancy at a very early level. As I said, it's the same vocal apparatus you use, and even if you have specific phonemes which are not used in one language and used in the other, still it usually doesn't hurt to have that in the picture. For example, we did this for, nearly 30 languages at the same time. There were some tonal languages involved. So on the input side, we even had to include tonal features, so which is like relative changes in pitch or pitch estimates. And certainly you would say, well, for most of the European languages, it doesn't make sense because we do not have tonal languages here. But we didn't see any language where it hurt. So if you have like additional features for a specific language, it will help for the overall picture, but it doesn't hurt for those languages where you possibly don't need that distinction. And in the end, you have this bottleneck layer, which gives you a fair amount of information reduction. So what you try, so the interpretation is that this bottleneck encodes, say, is a very high level encoding of speech already, which is nevertheless language independent, but covers all the necessary features for all the different languages. So moving over to under-resourced languages, so here we have the task that for the target language we have either 40 hours, which is okay, or only 3 hours, which is very few data. And if you train these, so the Gaussian part of your model is always trained only on the target language here, 3 hours only. But then you can train your bottleneck features also on the 3 hours or on the 40 hours or multilingually on 800 hours of data from different languages. And then you can compare to training with the model on 40 hours for both the bottleneck and the Gaussian mixture model. And what we can see is overall result is with the multilingual model, you get already near to the results you get by training on 40 hours. And this reduces the effort of building such a system considerably, because generating transcribed data is actually one of the problems we have to face, because it's costly. To transcribe 1 hour of speech with a low error rate, you assume that you need a factor of 20 to 30 times real time. So 1 hour of speech needs like 20 to 30 hours of human working time to generate the corresponding transcription. Although you don't need experts, it's native speakers which can write their language is sufficient, but still it's costly. And here you see an overview of quite a number of languages. And for each case, you can see that training multilingually, that's the VLLP, very limited language pack that's referring to, gives you always already similar results, especially in keyword search performance, as the case where you actually train on the 40 hours in a unilingual way.
Why do some languages have such much larger error rate?
If you have an answer to that question, you would be very happy, because you would make a lot of people happy. This was a 4-year project, and this was a constant topic of discussion. And it seems to be very difficult to deal. I mean, all the conditions were very, very, very similar. So all the data was generated in a normalized fashion in that project. So the differences cannot be explained by the data simply, because the amounts were similar. But the differences, it's really difficult.
Could one sit down with a difficult language and modify it acoustically so as to drop that error rate? I mean, one wonders.
I mean, it's not only the acoustics, it's also like the context dependency you have. So what is the structure of that language also on the syntactical level? And that's possibly not as easy to modify. Certainly, you can take any language and like use a phonetician to write down the phonemes. That would be the extreme case. And then certainly you can do optimal speech recognition on top of that if you have each and every phoneme correct, but that's possibly not.
Because you see, it's not just a question about how to make a difficult language easier, because I should imagine that you could use the same technology to improve language for somebody who was hearing impaired, for example.
Yeah, I possibly would like to let other people talk on that topic, like Thorsten Dowitt, who will be back here next week.
Thorsten's back next week.
Sorry? Yeah, so because I'm not really familiar with like hearing impaired situations, because they might be very specific to the kind of hearing impairment you have.
Is there any comparative psychoacoustics? Do you know if some of these languages have lower intelligibility ratings for humans trying to listen to them in noisy environments?
There have been some studies, but I think even in the project, but I would have to look that up. I can't tell you currently. So what you have certainly, I mean, the people who did the transcriptions, the recording and the transcription certainly also did quality measures for those transcriptions. And they surely don't explain the differences in the machine error rates you obtain. Yes?
It's a more general question, but like, have you ever looked at the errors itself networks do and tried to figure out some structure why the network isn't?
That's difficult. I mean, certainly you look into your results and you try to find, say, systematic errors, for example, but the networks itself, they are huge, and it's really, I mean, even if you see the network makes an error, you might be able to relate that to some or other portion of your training data if you're very lucky, but then still the question is, what can you do about that? So that's really difficult. Yeah, I know.
Okay.
There's one other topic, but maybe I can do that in the discussion at some point, because it's also more recent and ongoing research topic. Yeah. Okay.